It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Stacey has the week off, but Kevin Marks joins Jeff Jarvis and me. We're going to really talk about the fate of the world on this week's Google. We'll get a little philosophical. Of course, is Google too rich, too powerful to even consider being not evil? Facebook, too. Mark Zuckerberg's plan for world domination and a whole lot more. It's all on the table for This Week in Google next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 421, recorded Wednesday, September 6th, 2017. Not okay, Google. This Week in Google is brought to you by Qualcomm Snapdragon Gigabit LTE. To make the most of your unlimited data plan, go to snapdragon.com/gigabit. And by Captera. Captera is a free and easy-to-use software comparison site with over 400 categories of business software to choose from and thousands of reviews from actual software users like you. Visit captera.com/twig today. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we get together with some of the best Google minds and Facebook minds and Twitter minds in the mind of Jeff Jarvis, professor of journalism at the City University of New York and author of What Would Google Do and Private Public Parts and all sorts of stuff. BuzzMachine.com. Great to see you, Jeff.
Hey, always good to see you. Yeah.
Stacey has the week off, but we have the multi-talented Yorkshireman, Kevin Marks. IndieWeb.org.
Dr. Yorkshireman, I suppose.
Where are you? You're in Somerset. Where are you? I don't remember where you are.
No, I'm in Yorkshire.
You are in Yorkshire.
Call me a Yorkshireman is pushing a little. My wife's from here. I count as a Yorkshireman quite yet. I've only been 6 months.
Really? Or do you have to really be sixth generation to be a Yorkshireman?
No, you can. All right, you can adopt it.
I love Yorkshire people. I watched All Creatures Great and Small's in Yorkshire, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. I just love that. I love that.
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Beautiful country and a kind of a phlegmatic people. They're like people are from Maine around here, kind of like that. Just kind of, yep. We have so much to talk about. Let's start with the story that is just now breaking from the Washington Post. Facebook says, turns out we sold political ads to a shady Russian company during the election. They told congressional investigators today they discovered this to a company seeking to target U.S. voters, company in a Russian troll farm with sales of $100,000 of ads with a history of pushing pro-Kremlin propaganda. They directly named Republican nominee Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton.
I'll bet they did.
Most of the ads focused on pumping politically divisive issues such as gun rights and immigration fears, gay rights, racial discrimination. Wow.
Yeah.
But Facebook...
I'll bet that's not all.
Is it Facebook's job to block that kind of thing? I don't...
I would report it. Attention.
I would report it, yeah.
The question is, was it called to their attention and did they not do anything? But here's the problem. I take that back. How would it, if you saw the ad, how would you know it's a Russian ad?
Yeah.
We saw all this crap come across. And so the question is how does Facebook in the end know that it's a Russian company, and how could they have known, and how will they know in the future? We certainly saw that there was tons of Russian manipulation in the election. I've on this show before, I've quoted the NATO handbook on Russian information warfare, and it's a script for what we're going through. And so, yes, I think they have a responsibility to know so they stop it. The question is how do you know?
It is illegal for foreign nations to interfere in the U.S. elections.
No, it's illegal for them to...
To contribute.
To contribute, but it's not illegal for them. We have a First Amendment here.
They could buy ads.
If a foreigner wants to come over and say something about our election, they can do that.
The First Amendment applies to anybody. You don't have to be American to get protected by it.
Yes.
Okay. So this isn't an illegal...
This isn't illegal. It's just helping the scumballs.
Yeah. Does Facebook have a higher obligation than U.S. law to prevent this?
Yeah, certainly it does. the same way that, you know, if you're a news, again, I'm not trying to call them media, but if you're another medium that takes advertising, so if the Kremlin came along and wanted to buy an ad on CBS attacking Hillary Clinton on the behalf of Donald Trump, should CBS take the ad?
It's not just in politics, too. These ads can be used to spread misinformation. They're the Internet Research Agency, which is this troll farm in St. Petersburg. Nice name, the Internet Research Agency. Also, apparently, in 2013, by the way, 600 people employed across Russia. So it's a big troll farm. I'm sorry, 2015, the New York Times Magazine reported that the Internet Research Agency had launched social media campaigns in the U.S., including a sophisticated hoax that spread false news of a chemical leak in Louisiana in 2014, apparently to sow chaos and fear. So because, you know, I feel like there's not much we can do about this because the Internet has made us – this is the price we pay for being an open nation, the Internet and having an open Internet, right?
Well, I mean, there's back and forth on that. I mean, the UK is a fairly open nation, but we ban political advertising here and police it fairly, very closely. So there's.
But what about this disinformation campaign, which is not political advertising, but merely an attempt to sow chaos?
That's tough. That is
which
tough
is the goal.
With. Yeah, I mean,
that's the goal.
Yeah.
As Dana Boyd points out, is polarization is the goal. Attack right. on institutions.
A weak
is the
West
goal.
Is good for Putin.
Right, and so we play along. In media, when we end up repeating their agendas, when we debunk them, even when we fact check them, we help.
But, can we ask Facebook to do something that the U.S. law does not ask them to do? In other words, to block these things.
Sure, we ask them to not put up sleazy porn ads. We ask them not to put up sleazy drug ads. Google's taken down. You know, junky drug ads. I wish every media company would get rid of the likes of Rev Content and such. There's a lot of sleazy, junky ads out there. So, yeah, I think we can expect them to have quality. I've done some work with Storiful and Moat at the News Integrity Initiative at CUNY. And again, full disclosure, so folks know that it is funded in great measure by Facebook. But I have independence of Facebook. So we've started identifying the worst of the worst, lowest rotten hanging fruit of fake news sites, outright lies. I don't have the numbers now yet, but we'll put them out as soon as we have them. But some surprising proportion of ad revenue that at least one company sees passing by its sites from major companies goes to these bad sites. You have sleeping giants telling companies to get off Breitbart. Yeah, I think that there is at least a public and consumer expectation now to behave and not to support crap.
And there's no question that these social media campaigns and advertising campaigns are successful, can work. They're powerful.
I mean, oh, yes.
That's one of the things we've learned about Facebook is how powerful advertising is on Facebook. Here's another story. This is Dan Gooden writing in Ars Technica. A hacking group dubbed Dragonfly has been attacking U.S. and European energy companies since at least 2011, establishing beachheads in the electrical grid. Eric Chen, who is Technical Director of Symantec Security Response and Technology Division, said, "What's most concerning is we now see them intruding on operational networks of energy companies. They actually..." Before we were talking about them being one step away, what we see now is they're potentially in those networks, zero steps away from flipping the switch. There are no more technical hurdles for them to jump over. At minimum, attackers who have control of a company's operational network could use it to become de facto operators of the company's energy assets. That control includes the ability to turn on or off breakers inside the company's infrastructure, hijack systems that monitor the health of the grid. In other words, this looks like a concerted effort to undermine our grid. We saw it happen in Ukraine. Ukraine's considered to be the test bed for Russian hacking.
This is again why I recommend the NATO handbook on Russian information warfare, because it goes through exactly what was done and says that it's meant to turn us against each other. It's meant to turn us against the truth, to doubt the existence of truth. It's meant to turn us against institutions and divide us from each other as communities.
So they turned off the power in Kiev, just outside Kiev. About 225,000 people lost power for 6 hours. And then power went back on, but it was considered an effective test by one of these nation states, probably Russia. It's hard to know. Manual attacks, according to Symantec, are more difficult in the U.S. than in the Ukraine based on sheer size. In order to cause an effect, something or someone would need to flip the switch, deploy a crash device, etc. But we don't believe there are any technical hurdles in doing so. So, there's some good news. We should also point out that the this last week, I don't know if we reported it on this show, but the 7 members of the 32-member, or it was 24-member, let me look and see and get the number, a technical advisory committee to the president resigned, saying nobody's paying any attention to this stuff.
Those were, however, the hangover appointees from the Obama administration. Right.
Insufficient attention to threats. So it could have been purely political. The rest remain. It's a 27-member council. 7 resigned. Yeah, might not be anything. Although when you tie all these stories together, it's a little concerning. I hope we are paying attention to this stuff. Okay, I'll just start with the bad news.
What was the story that I loved today?
On the other hand, Oreo is out, so okay, good.
So here's a story that fascinated me today. Can I jump to one?
Yeah.
I want to hear what you have to say about it. That Facebook is ready to pay hundreds of millions of dollars for music rights. If I interpret this right, so on one hand, this seems to be, we don't know how to keep your music from being pirated, so we'll just pay you and go away. But on the other hand, this enables users to then use music in their videos.
I think that's more powerful. That's more the point.
Right? That's what it is. I wasn't misinterpreting it. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That Facebook would enable its users. I mean, they might as well buy a stock photo agency too for memes. And you can make content here and make it freely and it won't get taken down for all these stupid reasons.
Well, I think
that's phenomenal.
A good kind of template for this is Jiffy, right? Jiffy makes these animated GIFs that everybody now uses. They're animated. I just got them in Gboard, the Google keyboard. I can now paste animated GIFs into my texts and so forth. So what's happened in the past, of course, is the recording industry has demanded that YouTube and Facebook pull down anything with copyrighted music. Facebook's saying, well forget that. Why don't we just give you some money and people can use the music?
That's what YouTube does as well, of course.
Right. YouTube does that. In fact,
YouTube does that, but YouTube doesn't allow you to use the music, the users to use the music in their videos. This enables the user to use the video without being taken down.
It does. Yeah. If you insert copyright music, it'll say this is copyright music. And depending on what the label has decided, they get the advertising revenue for it, or they get a buy link attached to it.
I think that's different. Right, got it. But I think this is different, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's only an inch, not a foot. But in that case, YouTube is either paying ad revenue to the music company because they left it up, or they take it down, or the user can buy it. In this case, Facebook, I think what Facebook is just saying, we'll buy it for everybody.
Lucas Shaw and Sarah Fryer, writing in Bloomberg Technology, say that the music industry executives also hope licensing songs for user-generated video on Facebook will place greater pressure on YouTube to behave. Yet by further empowering Facebook to host video and music, rights holders risk creating another YouTube, a great source of promotion, but a place where consumption outpaces sales. The good news is the music industry grew 5.9% in 2016.
What's the chart look like? I don't even know how much did it shrink before it started growing again.
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question.
Well, it depends where you measure from.
Right. So Universal Music Group, owner of the world's largest record label, reported a 15.5% increase in sales in the most recent quarter. Warner Music Group, the second of the big three, said a 13% increase in sales. So this is going to be an even better year. So the good news is the music industry has found ways to make money, particularly from streaming services. You know, that's the real way to make money these days, from Spotify and Apple Music and so forth. So in a second quarter earnings call, Mark Zuckerberg said, for the next few years, video will drive our business and determine how well we perform. And we're going to continue to invest in the format. This is an interesting story related. The rights to James Bond are for sale. And among the usual bidders for James Bond, Apple and Amazon. So I guess the rights to James Bond are owned by MGM. They've been trying to sell it off for a couple of years. Sony, Universal, and Fox have been pursuing it. Warner's and Sony, the most aggressive. But according to Hollywood Reporter, Apple, with its newly arrived executives from Sony Pictures Television, is in the running. It's about Apple could easily afford the franchise. Apparently, you too could buy the rights to James Bond for a mere $2 to $5 billion. Mm-hmm. In the world of Lucasfilm, which of course is Star Wars and Marvel, Bond feels really underdeveloped, says someone familiar with the process. I mean, look how well Star Wars has
been around forever.
Yeah, but Star Wars has done so well for Disney. They have turned that into a money machine. There's going to be a movie every year. Every movie makes almost enough money to pay off the purchase in the first place. They've got the Disneyland. Star Wars is under construction. They're going to have a Star Wars hotel. Marvel's been huge for Netflix. It's done so well. And, of course, the Marvel movies have made tons of money. Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's never been Bond movies have continued to be cranked out. What were there, 60 of them, right?
Well, they ran out of novels a long time ago, didn't they?
Yeah, Daniel Craig is apparently, despite his complaints about playing Bond, back for another Bond outing at the end of next year. No. It takes a long time to make these. 2 years, November 8th, 2019. They haven't started making it yet, I guess. It'd be funny if Apple bought Bond. I think Amazon. It'd be great. Amazon's been underwriting some really good movies lately. And I think that maybe either Amazon or Apple would be more willing to take chances than traditional movie companies. That's one of the things that I think Disney has done such a good job with Star Wars, by taking some chances and winning Star Wars fans over. The biggest, it was Force Friday last Friday, and I don't know how many R2-D2s and BB-8s they sold, but a ton of them. Everybody's talking about them for Christmas. That'll be the Christmas gift, I'm sure. The Sphero R2-D2s and the new BB-8, the dark BB-8. All right. So you see, that was some happy news.
That was a little bit happy.
Cheered everybody up.
Kind of.
We talked about it Sunday on Twit. I can't remember if we talked last week about the think tank.
Yeah, we did.
So there was a follow-up that we didn't have, which was, of course, Kashmir Hill's article.
Which was very good.
Yeah, although you're the journalism expert, so I'm curious what your take is on this. Kashmir, of course, we love Kashmir Hill. She's great.
She's a great reporter.
Doing special projects for Gizmodo. She writes, yes, Google uses its power to quash ideas it doesn't like. I know, because it happened to me. She's been telling this story apparently at bars for some time. She said that. I didn't make that up. It's been a good bar story for her. But when she worked at Forbes, so this is, I don't think it's completely clear, Jeff, but I want your take on this as a journalism professor, as an ethics expert. She was both a reporter for Forbes, but also managing social media, and wearing her hat as the social media arm, was invited to a meeting with Google, which was about to roll out its Google Plus social network. Google salespeople had made the other executive sign an NDA. Apparently, she did not know about that, did identify herself as a reporter, but was then told by the Google salespeople, Forbes should add the plus one button to its site right next to the already Facebook like button and Reddit share button. They said, this is Kashmir's writing, it was important to do so because the plus recommendations would be a factor in search results a crucial source of traffic to publishers. This sounded like a news story to me. Google's dominance in search and news give it tremendous power over publishers. So she said, did I just hear correctly? If a publisher doesn't put a plus one button on the page, its search results would suffer? The salespeople said yes. She did the right thing immediately afterwards. She went to Google's public relations team as a reporter, not as a social media person, told them that she'd been in the meeting, said, did I understand correctly? This press office said yes. We prefer to say the plus button influences the ranking, but they didn't deny what their salespeople told me. She says, if you don't feature the plus one button, your stories will be harder to find with Google. So she published a story headlined, stick Google plus buttons on your pages or your search traffic suffers. That is a big story. Google complained, saying that was an NDA'd meeting. She can't write about that. They asked her editors to take it down. They went to her and said, take it down. I'm not sure why, but I guess they had.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway,
they had a very strange CMS in those days. She probably had to.
You can't log in and take it down, but could you? She said, I thought it was an important story, but I didn't want to cause problems for my employer. And if everybody was covered by an NDA, I can understand why Google would object. She said, because I'd gone to the PR team and before publishing, it was already out there. I felt it more sense to keep the story up. But after continued pressure from my bosses, I took the piece down, a decision I will always regret. Now, this next piece, I think, doesn't prove anything. But she says then the cache results of the story were deleted and you couldn't find that story. Google's crawler just didn't show that story. She said that was a little suspicious to me. She got a very good letter from Google after she published this story in Gizmodo. Their response was, I thought, well written.
Well, I didn't see that.
Yeah. Hi, Kashmir. I want to clear the air on this. We've always enjoyed working respectfully with you and are sad that you've carried this since 2011. I'm sorry about how this went down. I wanted to give you the TikTok from our end. Let me tell you who's writing here so you can. It's Rob Shulkin, who's Vice President of Global Communications at Google. From our perspective, this was a disagreement over whether a meeting was held under an NDA. Our sales team, I'll go on. You can read more about that. I understand our PR rep asked the piece come down from Forbes' website as it was reporting on a confidential business meeting. Your editor agreed. He told our PR rep the article was being removed because it involved reporting on an NDA meeting. As for the Google cache, and this is important, it's trivial for the website owner to request that the cache be cleared. I assume this is what happened because we had nothing to do with removing the article from the cache. We would never engage in this type of behavior. I hope you understand that. You've long held our and the tech industry's feet to the fire on privacy issues. You've written more than a few critical stories about Google Plus and many other things. To my knowledge, never have we had any issues like this, even with the most critical story. So after reading this, Jeff, I feel like, well, it was an NDA'd meeting. It wasn't her.
She
should have been told it was an NDA'd meeting.
So what was there was a case with the Guardian and the private confessions site that used to exist. Oh God, you remember what that was? Where people would go on anonymously and confess things.
Secret.
Yeah, it was a secret. Okay, I guess.
Post secret. Yeah.
Was it? No, I don't think it was post secret.
Anyway,
the same thing happened. A business meeting where journalists were part of it, because journalists are now the walls aren't clear. So journalists are part of product. Journalists can sit in the meeting with product with somebody else. It's all mushed in now. And a journalist knows something. And so the Guardian said, our greater goal, our greater responsibility here is to the public. And they reported that information was being. I wish I could remember the details of the story. I'm sure somebody in the chat room has it. Information on users was not as private as they thought. It was a mushy story in lots of ways. At some level, I think that the journalist has to ask where her obligation lies first. And I would say it lies first with the public.
To be clear, she had not signed the NDA. If she'd signed the NDA, this would be a different.
She called the PR people. So what happens if instead of me with Forbes, Google had the same meeting with Business Week, and over that drink that apparently Kashmir enjoys, and that Google also had at the end of his letter, over that drink, the business person Business Week says, Kashmir, you cover Google. I got to tell you, this thing just happened. And that person may have violated an NDA, But like a reporter, yeah. whether it's Snowden or anybody else, when the reporter finds it out, reporter's obligation is to free the information.
If you haven't signed the NDA or agreed this is off the record, or because you are, she, and I'm sure Kashmir does honor it. If somebody says this is off the record, she doesn't report that, right?
Right.
Regardless of the public's interest.
Is that Google made a mistake in asking for it to be taken down back in the day. Whether it was NDA or not, once it was out, it was out. And for Google to be caught in the right to be forgotten problem, and Google to argue that we shouldn't be erasing history, for the Google to then go to a media company and try to erase history.
Don't say the G word.
I said it too often.
Yeah.
That I would say.
No, Google's not listening. Oh no.
You said it's not okay. That was the problem.
Not okay, that's, Google.
Not okay, Google.
Okay, so that's the one issue. One issue.
I suspect the other half of this is that it's the left hand not know what the right hand is doing is like Google itself.
Right.
I'm fairly sure that Matt would have been very, very grumpy about the salespeople saying that about search ranking and corrupting the work that they were doing to keep
that's
search
the question.
Rankings pure.
So that's the second question. We can go back and forth over Kashmir's obligations, the NDA, and so forth. But no one's denied the essential assertion of her article that the plus one helped your search rankings. You don't think that's true, Kevin?
Well, you know, if I was being Matt, I'd say there are many thousands of factors that influence search rankings, and we can't disclose them. You know, so probably the plus one does have something for the search ranking. Sure, it will mean that they've been pinged and they're more likely to crawl and things like that.
Right.
And if you want an analogy, you know, the current argument around this is AMP pages. AMP pages influence your search ranking because if you have them, you show up in the carousel.
Right.
So they don't influence your ranking, but they do influence your placement.
Right.
And so that's a tricky one for, you know, Google is dancing around that at the moment. And they're arguing it in good faith on both sides to some extent, but from the media company's point of view, the reason they're doing AMP is to improve their search ranking. In practice, it's improving their search ranking because their pages actually load rather than just sit there and spin at you while junk downloads onto your phone. But you know, the reason that the carrot there is that if they show up in the carousel, and any of these, when you're a company that big, a carrot and a sticker is not that. You know, it's a bit hard to distinguish them. That's the challenge.
So let me go to the larger thing. So there's also a story I put in the rundown just now. Josh Marshall from Talking Points Memo, who's a really wonderful entrepreneurial journalist, goes through a saga of how he has felt under the gun of Google just as a small business owner. And so I started writing a post about all this, and I it was too big to write. So I thought instead I would talk about it here. I'm often in the position where I defend Silicon Valley and the platforms against those who presume bad motive and bad behavior. And I still do that and still believe that. But there are those who now argue that the platforms, because they are too big in their view, and because they control the internet, should be regulated, which I, as you know, I fear. But it is true in my mind that the platforms have a much higher obligation to virtue than even they have presented. And as I was thinking about this, I've defended Don't Be Evil because I knew where it came from. It came from Paige and Brin saying, keep us honest employees. But there's a little bit of, I want to say cynicism in there, but that's not going far enough. That do good is what their goal should be. And there are those who will say that it's impossible. Companies will always put profit before everything else. Companies can't do good. But we've seen these days that doing evil has a much higher price than it used to because of exactly what we're doing right now. Because we can talk about the companies, we can learn about them, we can spread this. So I think that the company, the Silicon Valley, and the companies are still far, far too much in the mode of thinking people understand that we do wonderful things. They have to go out of their way. Eric Schmidt should have said to New America, "I'm going to disagree with this article, but don't you dare do anything about it. Don't you dare get rid of this guy. Don't do anything about it because we welcome different opinions. And if we give you money, we expect that. And that's what we want." Google should have said, don't you ever kill a story. They need people inside these companies who think from an ethical framework at a very high level. Because otherwise, they're going to get zapped by the regulators. They're going to get zapped by PRs. It's bad business. And they also have a higher responsibility because they control our internet.
And by the way, in this discussion, replace Google with Facebook, you'd have much the same discussion.
Same exact discussion. So, and last week I criticized Facebook for having hired
same issues.
A person in charge of transparency who most journalists don't have a lot of respect for.
So Josh's point is kind of that when you get as big and powerful as Google, the wielding of the power doesn't have to be kind of heavy-handed and obvious. It's just in the nature of things. And I think this is true of Facebook. The publishers rely on Google, and Google wields great power with them. And in that respect, the same thing with Facebook. Publishers are at Google's mercy. He says, this is actually a good analogy that might help people understand it. He says, if you're a Star Trek fan, you'll understand this analogy. It's a bit like being assimilated by the Borg. You get cool new powers, but having been assimilated, if your implants were ever removed, you'd certainly die. That basically captures our relationship to Google. So it's not all bad for publishers. In fact, it's so good for publishers, as is Facebook, that it's hard to turn your back on the candy.
So what they have to do is they have to have a higher level of standards. They have to put out principles beyond just don't be evil.
Do they do this?
And say,
do you think?
To some extent, there's some statements, but I think that what I'm saying is because they control our internet, because they are so big, because they are under watch, they've got to be better than any other company.
I've always kind of said this in a different way, but that Google should be like a priesthood. One way to handle this is when you imbue somebody with this much power, you also have to instill in them, and it's a little bit of a mythos, but you instill in them this higher responsibility that it's like a police officer. You give them a gun, but you have to instill in them this sense of, this is for the greater good, and I'm committing my life to the greater good. I would even give my life for the greater good. Otherwise, giving them the gun could be a problem.
Well, that's it. That is the point of don't be evil. That was the point there. It was to say, step back and think about this in moral terms.
That's not enough.
I'm not saying it's enough. No, absolutely. The other thing here is
that's why I say a priesthood. You need to have rituals and robes and incense. You need to,
and a Bible.
You got to go. Yeah, you need a Bible. You need to instill this as a holy faith.
No, yeah, that can go. That can backfire. You know, that can backfire.
That can be wrong too,
because then they get accused of being holier than thou, and we're perfect and we're wonderful. But no, you have to be more monks. You have to be more supplicants. You have to be humble. You have to know that you're going to screw up. You have to be held to principles that you set. This is not easy, but hey, you got all the benefits in the world. You're the biggest brands and biggest companies and huge growth. You're controlling the damn internet. We have to hold you to a higher standard. You have to hold yourself to a higher standard.
Right. So there's, I'm going to talk about three things here. One is that there's this soft power has a sort of secondary insidious thing, which is that it's not necessarily actually influence. It's just the idea that it might be is very chilling. I'm fairly sure Schmidt didn't say, sack these guys, shut them up.
Yes.
But
don't.
But the emails were, you're not being collegiate. You'll damage. You'll piss Google off, and then the other part of our group won't get funding. So stop talking out against Google. So she was explicitly saying, do not speak against our major funders.
Right. It probably. That's what's insidious about it. It might not even. Google may have exerted zero pressure. Eric Schmidt may have never said anything. Right. He didn't have to. It was understood.
They have to be conscious of that. They have to be conscious of that.
Well, can they?
This is so much on my mind because I took a lot of money from Facebook for the News Integrity Initiative, and we negotiated independence. And this is exactly why. But I have to be very conscious. I didn't write about the case of Facebook hiring the former New York Times public editor Liz Spade to be in charge of transparency and how I thought it was a bad hire, because it took me so long to figure out how to write it. It was over, but it was too late.
But would you agree that this is something journalists are constantly challenging themselves? A good journalist is constantly challenging themselves with, am I biased here? Am I looking out for the good of my employer versus the good of,
enough.
And that's where I mean the priesthood, because a good reporter has to hold as her highest ethic that I'm here for the people, right? I'm here to speak truth to power. I'm here to represent the people, not my employer, for instance.
Yes.
Yeah.
We do that sometimes to an obnoxious extent. I mean, I've seen.
I don't think it may be obnoxious. Who cares? It needs to be done. I'm saying.
No. What I'm saying is, I've seen cases where
arrogant.
Well, no, I've seen cases where the business side of a newspaper will do a deal with a company, and every reporter will back over themselves to not ever for that company and to try to expose how awful that company because the business side didn't. They can go.
We deal with that all the time. I tell our people. You know, you need to know who our sponsors are. You need to disclaim it when you're doing a story on our sponsors. And you can't give our sponsors favorite treatment. But on the other hand, you can't be – it's very hard to do. You can't be a negative about them either. If possible, put it out of your mind that they're a sponsor and report exactly as you would have if they weren't. That is very hard to do.
And
it gets really hard if you're not – this is a flat institution. So advertising is right here. There's no firewall between editorial and advertising in a podcast because we do the ads. So it's a very challenging thing to do.
Nor is there in a product world in a news organization now where you're creating new products all the time. And in that team, you have technology and marketing and sales and editorial and all in together, which is the way it should be. So that's why the priesthood doesn't extend just to the journalists. It extends to everybody in the company. And part of – I think that people in media companies, every employee should be trained in the eternal verities of journalism and the cause of what they're doing and why they exist. Similarly, on Google and Facebook and Twitter, for God's sakes, all the platforms that stand in this powerful position, I think that they've got to do a lot more in thinking about their moral authority, and not to claim it, they don't, but not to presume it, they don't do that either, but to earn it and earn it every day and hold each other honest to that. Same goes, by the way, let me say for media. I think that we in media don't grapple enough with the fact that paywalls redline journalism away from poor people. Reach-based advertising brings us to clickbait, which doesn't just mean cats and Kardashians. It also meant, watch out here, Donald Trump. The conflicts that we have in media, the ways we're trying to save ourselves, the ways we're forgetting what our real mission is, we ain't pure. We ain't clean either. I'm not holding us to any higher standard, I don't think, or lower standard. But we all have a larger societal responsibility.
Kevin, you wrote an article, a blog post. I really like this. You posted a link to it in the chat room. Otherwise, I would not have known about it because you wrote it 14 years ago in your blog, Epaeus Epigone, about morality.
You're just showing off you know how to say that, Leo.
I don't. I'm making it up. I don't know what it means. Let's put the edifying, exquisite equine entrapments. But this is along those lines, isn't it? These are the kind of ethical standards.
This was Jane Jacobs wrote this book a long time ago called Systems of Society. I think it was Systems of Survival. That was it. Which is about there are two primary moralities, two sort of cultures. There's the commercial culture and there's the guardian culture. And the difference between them is that the commercial culture has a coherent ethos and the guardian governmental priesthood type thing you're talking about has a coherent ethos. And when you mix them, it gets difficult. And so there's a whole book about it, which is well worth reading if you want to pick that up. But this post sort of... was trying to say, oh, could we come up with a new one that's not commercial and is not Guardian, but is open source? So it's trying to come up with these kinds of, trying to come up with a sort of open source, open web version of these ideals. And I'm not saying this is fully thought through, but it was very interesting to read this.
Yeah.
And that is the challenge. You have to step back and think about these things because her point, the underlying Jane Jacobs point is that the commercial thing is consistent in itself, and it is designed to you avoid force, you trade, use initiative, you're honest, you're optimistic, there's hope, and you respect contracts and so on. And you compete, and there's a sort of structure to that. And there's a coherence in the guardian, the priesthood mode, which is you have a monopoly, you should not be trading, you work within the system. There's a set of things you do if you're in that mode. You respect the hierarchy and the tradition, and you're obedient. And there's a coherent morality there, which can be useful in circumstances too. And the challenge is, if you get them mixed up, then you end up with a mafia, or you end up with the kind of sort of corruption that we're talking about with the Russian state or things like that. And the worry is that we have moved towards that. Since you wrote this book in America and in the UK to some extent as well, where we have this, we've mixed this idea that the government and the commerce are running in separate spheres. They're now running these overlapping spheres.
So and that's the challenge of the. I've been thinking about this a lot too, because I feel like one of the reasons we're in shaky times. I mean, that you wrote this in 2003, where it was. God, that was a long time ago.
Those were the days, my friends.
Where you had a merchant ethic and you had a mercenary ethic or a guardian ethic. And I love the desire to create an information ethic and all of these attributes. But these are all based on a mythos that one has to buy into. That's what, you need true believers, because if you're a police officer, for instance, or a monk, or a priest, you need to kind of be a true believer in the tenets of that holy order in order to enforce that. And the problem is that I think not only are we living in a post-fact world, we're living in a post-mythos world, or maybe such a highly fragmented mythos that everybody has their own, and there's no agreement anymore on a moral framework or...
Kellyanne Conway was actually
It's all made up anyway, and it's kind of like Bitcoin versus fiat currency. Bitcoin undermines fiat currency because you suddenly realize, just as Bitcoin is based on nothing, neither is the dollar bill, and it all can start to crumble if people stop believing. It's all made up.
Yes.
And as soon as people don't hold these truths to be self-evident, even because they're not, they're all made up. But as soon as people kind of see through that and we get in a post-fact society, everything falls apart.
Kellyanne Conway was more prescient than she certainly knew when she talked about alternative facts.
She may have understood that. It may be that she understood that. I'll give her more credit than you do.
By the way, I just put it on the rundown. Facebook, Alex Stamos, the chief security officer of Facebook, just put up an update on the Russian ads.
Oh, good. Let me look it up. Okay. So that's what I feel like we're in this, why we're in these,
I think we
this
are.
Time of
yeah.
shifting sands. So an update on information operations on Facebook.
Skip to the very bottom. We will continue to invest in our people and technology to help provide a safe place for civic discourse and meaningful connections. They call this misuse of their platform.
Alex, by the way, is awesome. And I have huge respect for him.
Where was Alex before?
He was at Uber before, wasn't he? Somewhere not so good.
Yeah, so was. Yeah, yeah.
No, he was at Yahoo. I'm sorry. He was at Yahoo, and he left because there was a breach, and Marissa Meyer didn't tell him, and he was so affronted.
That's what it was.
That he walked out the door and went over to Facebook. But he's a good security guy.
Mm. So 3,000 ads, about 470 inauthentic accounts and pages in violation of our policies.
Interesting.
We don't allow inauthentic accounts on Facebook. They've shut down. The vast majority of these ads were run by accounts that didn't specifically reference U.S. presidential election voting or other candidates. Rather, the ads and accounts appear to focus on amplifying divisive social and political messages across the ideological spectrum. One quarter were geographically targeted, and of those, more ran in 2015 and 16. The majority displayed by these accounts amplified divisive messages were consistent with the techniques mentioned in the white paper we released in April about information operations.
It's hard to get people interested or upset about this, isn't it? I mean, you can say, look, we're being manipulated. People go, yeah, not really. I'm not worried about it.
Oh, this is this is what, read the Data and Society report, read the yeah, NATO report, read the RAND report.
We know about it.
We know it, but
I don't think the general public gives two figs about it.
And that's part of the point, is that's part of the goal. The goal is to make them say, you're all corrupt and nothing's true anyway, and there is no...
That's exactly right. The goal is to break down the mythos America is a myth.
It is.
Yeah, it's a myth, but it's a myth that we need to believe in if we're going to continue to move forward. And so, but it's very fragile if you can get people to say, I've been seeing this for years, geeks especially, saying, oh, governments, it doesn't make any difference. It's meaningless. It's corrupt. I'm not going to participate.
Institutions are myths. Education is a myth.
Myths.
Expertise is a myth.
It's all myths.
Right, and it's when we, if we believe in it, bricks go on top.
What's what makes society? It's what makes civilization. Civilization is fundamentally a myth, but it's but if you want order, you need to get people to believe in it, at least somewhat, or at least pay lip service to it.
What I concentrate a lot these days is civility. I think part of what's happening is that. We have the institutions of yore. We have government, media, corporations, NGOs. And there's a fifth institution, which is communities. And there's a great good to be had in that. I find my people. I can connect with people. I can do things with them. There's also a bad in that. People who aren't in my community are bad. The strangers are others. I trust my friends and my community more than I do doctors and lawyers and accountants and professors. We're at a point where people are refiguring their allegiances and beliefs around these institutions.
Yeah.
It's hard times. And it ain't going to be, we're too old. All of us are too old to see how this turns out. Sorry.
I worry about you're right. And in some ways I kind of am glad about that, but I worry about my kids. We all have kids roughly the same age who are entering this new world.
Yep.
And it's not a world like we grew up in. It's a very different world. It's not a world like 2003.
Those innocent days, Kevin.
You know, you've got fairly intractable problems, not to mention superstorms heading up the coast. I mean, it's terrifying. I feel like I'm trying to, in my own mind, am I just getting old? Is this really look bad? is this objectively bad?
This is a bad couple years.
I feel
years.
Like it's objectively bad, but I don't know. Yeah. I mean,
it ain't World War II.
So part of it is 2003, we didn't have this power. So it was easy for us to pontificate about it and do this because 2003, Google wasn't what it is now. And part of this comes from this sort of weird thing where these companies overshoot on their scrappiness. Because they start out as the outsider and they've got to compete with the status quo, and it takes them a while to realize they've become the status quo. So if you're, if you're Larry Page, you may still think of yourself as the scrappy outsider, even though you're now the CEO of the biggest source of information in the world. And this was very much true of Intel, and it was true of Microsoft, and to some extent it's true of Google as well. And I'm sure, Facebook had that sense as they were growing too. You start out being the outsider, and you're saying there is this establishment, there is these power centers, there's all this stuff going on in the world. We're just this little company, there's 10 of us, and we're trying to do this thing. But then you ramp up and you overshoot on that sort of sense of being the outsider that's trying to change the world, and don't realize that you are an establishment. And also that you're treated as an establishment as well. And so they may not, this was certainly true when I was working at Google, however long ago it was, 8-9 years ago, was that the execs didn't quite realize how much power they had, and they'd make this pronouncement, then PR would have to go spend a lot of time cleaning up after them because they'd said something that they thought was, a thought experiment and everyone else thought was a policy statement. When Larry said, it would be nice if we had an island somewhere that didn't have any laws so we could experiment with this stuff.
That was a little peek under the curtain there, wasn't it?
I also think that was the last time he had a...
He never went public again. That was his last public... utterance.
I'm fairly sure he got a bit of a telling off. Yes.
By whom? Who is going to tell Larry Page off? Sergey?
What's her face? Who's
their PR person?
The one who's now at Uber. What's her name? British lady.
Yeah.
You know what I mean. Anyway, we'll come back. Her name will come back to me. A lot of the, you know,
she's not at Uber anymore. She left and went to Facebook.
Yeah, she didn't last very long. Oh, she went to Facebook. Oh, there you go.
Facebook now. Oh, there you go.
Yeah, there you go. I think Mark Zuckerberg, people said, Rachel, why would Whetstone. He want to be president of the, who, Rachel?
Rachel Whetstone.
Whetstone.
Sorry. Rachel Whetstone.
People say, why would Mark Zuckerberg want to take a step down and become president of the United States? I suddenly realized he doesn't want to be president of the United States.
No.
He sees a world, a one world power. He wants to rule the world.
Well, no.
So here's the question. Here's the stupid kind of
Are we US moving in that direction?
Well, here's let me ask it this way. Here's a stupid question for you. This is like a USA Today stupid poll. Who's more powerful today?
Right.
Larry Page or Donald Trump?
Well, Trump's got nukes. So there is
true,
there is a little bit of a
We hope he can't use them.
Well, he can. And so I think that's the problem is government isn't on the same scale as enterprise. However,
no.
Because of the rise of multinational.
Wars are now fought with bits, yeah. not necessarily with
I think we're approaching that era.
But Schmidt used to say this. Schmidt would say, who do you trust more to tell you the truth, the government or Google?
Right. I think they're on equal.
And, you know, he was making it explicit then.
Neither.
And, a lot of the time, no, but we do trust Google. I mean, Google is, you know, now it'll give us some answers. Nowadays, it will often give us wrong answers and we'll call them out on it and they'll gradually fix it. But
it's kind of like those three moralities. I think neither yes. one will tell you, they'll tell you their truth.
Okay. I've got a clip for you. If you can play a clip. Can you play a clip?
Right now we're having trouble, I think, with our switcher because it's been sitting on Jeff for a while and that's happened.
We don't want Jeff to have too much airtime. No.
You put it in the chat room?
It's clear proof it's broken.
It's in the chat room. All right. Let me open this up.
It's a TV clip from
This is Terry Pratchett. You put this quote up earlier. I like this. This is from a movie called Hogfather.
Well, it was originally a novel by Terry Pratchett called Hogfather. This is the TV version of it.
Are you getting my audio, Karsten? Do you know? Okay, here we go. This is
Susan Death's granddaughter talking to Death at the end of the time where they've defeated the auditors and restored Christmas or Hogsmas. Anyway,
the key thing you need to know is the male voice here is Death.
Yes. And Susan is Death's grandmother, is actually fixing
human.
Okay, let me go back.
You're saying that humans need fantasies to make life bearable?
No. Humans need fantasy to be human. To be the place where the falling angel meets the rising ape.
With tooth fairies, hogfathers.
Yes. As practice, you have to start out learning to believe the little lies.
So we can believe the big ones.
Yes. Justice, mercy, duty, that sort of thing.
They're not the same at all.
You think so? Then take the universe and grind it down to the finest powder and sieve it through the finest sieve. And then show me one atom of justice, one molecule of mercy. And yet, you try to act as if there is some ideal order in the world, as if there is some rightness in the universe by which it may be judged.
But people have got to believe that. What's the point?
You need to believe in things that aren't true. How else can they become?
Wow. I love that. That's awesome.
And I've Lady Mary.
Yeah. I've never seen Hogfather.
You need to watch Hogfather.
Yeah.
Watch it at Christmas. It's a Christmas movie. It's not kind of Christmas, but it's very well done. It's about 4 hours long.
Terry Pratchett, who is, he reminds me a lot of Douglas Adams, both of whom understood this thing that, you know, eventually everybody comes to realize it's all made up. And then now what? Let's take a break. Kevin Marks is here undermining our very most fundamental beliefs. He does that from time to time at IndieWeb.org. Jeff Jarvis, he's pretty much the same. He's at BuzzMachine.com, and we are talking about all sorts of stuff. I could talk about a shiny object. I got the new Essential phone.
I'm dying to hear about that.
Oh, good. This is what we need to distract ourselves. Things like this, little shiny objects.
Yes.
This show is way too smart for me. I hope you're enjoying it. Our show today brought to you by a great company doing great stuff, Qualcomm, and the Qualcomm Snapdragon Gigabit LTE. This is empowering devices, and many of the newest devices you're using are actually using this Snapdragon Gigabit. Go to snapdragon.com/gigabit. To find out more, the Samsung Galaxy Note 8, the S8 Active, the Moto Z Force, the HTC U11, the Galaxy S8. These are all devices with this new Gigabit LTE designed to deliver the fastest mobile connectivity and help speed things up in crowded places. LTE, Gigabit LTE, 4x4 MIMO, many channels to let your data flow on and squeeze more speed from every LTE connection. It's like driving on a much wider, much faster data highway. Download speeds on average LTE download speeds are up to 7 times faster than your home Wi-Fi. It could turbocharge all your connected apps. Download the latest game from the Play Store on the go faster than you can at home. Access all your files in the cloud nearly as fast as you would if they were stored on your phone. Load Android Instant apps, well, almost instantly. Snapdragon Gigabit LTE technology. It uses the network so much more efficiently, you'll be leaving plenty of room for others to make the most of their data plans as well. There's a lot more information. That's just the 30,000 foot, but there's a lot more information on the page. Make the most of your unlimited data plan with epic download speeds and the newest Android devices at snapdragon.com/gigabit. Carrier aggregation 4x4 MIMO, 256 QAM. LTE ULAA, and there's a lot of information, including some great Snapdragon podcasts that explain it all. Snapdragon Gigabit LTE. Find out more at snapdragon.com/gigabit. We thank Qualcomm for their support.
Wow! Wait. That's fascinating in itself. Has Qualcomm ever advertised?
Not that I know of.
Modems inside of phones.
Well, it's like, it reminds me of Intel Inside. Remember, Intel spent a lot of money to persuade you that Intel chips are better?
But that was just kind of branding saying, oh, we're Intel and you trust us and we're wonderful, you've heard of us. This is interesting because it's also a specific consumer benefit.
Well, but they're also, advertised. I mean, notice where they're buying the ad. They're aiming at a technically literate audience.
Oh, no, I get that. But that's very cool.
Yeah, I'm when they called us up, I said, yeah, you bet.
Talk about an advertiser that's appropriate for the show.
Absolutely. In fact, there's rumors that Microsoft's going to announce new Surface devices running Qualcomm ARM chips. So
I had it right now because I'm downloading Oreo. I just got it.
Ah, hallelujah.
Just got the offer, and it's not going fast enough. It would go faster with a Snapdragon Gigabit LTE.
I have to think that the Pixel 2 will have it. Yeah.
You have it?
I gave up. I finally went to the beta channel and said, okay.
Yeah, no, I just got it.
The Pixel XL gave it to me yesterday, yeah.
Yeah, it's coming out now. Do you notice any difference? I don't notice a huge amount of difference.
There's some subtle things. The Ars Technica review was really helpful because, as often is the case with these things, it told me a bunch of things that I was like, did that change or was...
Yeah, you know. Ron Amadio did a brilliant job. This is a 20,000-word review.
it's unbelievable. It is... The piece I just linked to actually ties up back with the Qualcomm thing, because this I hadn't actually clocked this in detail before, and you've probably covered this all about Android already, but one of the key changes they've made in Oreo is the ability to upgrade parts of the OS independently of the OEMs.
Project Treble.
Project Treble, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, this is Google's had to do this because The biggest problem with Android is these older Android phones that just will never be secure because they'll never be upgraded. So by extracting bits of the OS, they've been doing this for a while and making it updatable.
Part of the point, what they said was they realized that they were dealing with huge numbers of OEMs. They were dealing with a bunch of carriers. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on, but they were dealing with a smaller number of chipset makers. And so what they did was they said, okay, let's define hardware abstraction layers around the chipsets.
Yes.
And then we'll simplify the problem because we're dealing with Qualcomm and a few other chip makers like them. And we can work with them directly. And once we've got that piece abstracted, then the OEMs can layer on some software stuff in between. So they basically restructured the software stack to focus on the abstracting the hardware out, so that it's easier to deploy this stuff in multiple stages. So
isn't this what Microsoft did years ago with their hardware abstraction layer? The idea of, because there was such heterogeneity in the hardware that they had to really lift the operating system above that and then have a layer that interfaced with the hardware.
And to some extent, Apple does it too, except Apple does this. Apple has a hardware abstraction layer and they have multiple vendors and they get them to compete for each piece of the stack they're building, and then they pick one for each release. So, you know, way back when I was at Apple, even longer ago than the 2000-ish, the point there was we would define a hardware abstraction layer, and then we would go to the vendors and say, okay, implement this hardware abstraction layer, we'll see which one of you does better, and we'll ship that one in this product. And the goal was always to have more than one vendor for each piece of the system, so that you could have multiple bids no one was able to hold you hostage. That's less true now. And part of the reason they end up buying some of those companies and doing these long-term deals was that they are so much of the market, it's harder for them to ramp up the delivery of the vendors and so on. But this is a similar thing. It's they said, okay, there's a choke point here. We can have a large number of OEM vendors who build different devices and things on the end, but there's only so many chipsets that are made because making a chipset is a huge investment of time and money and physical silicon and stuff.
So Ron points out that to update Android, Google has to go, but after Google does its update, it then has to go through three major steps, going to the system on a chip vendors like Qualcomm or Samsung and get them, get them to, vet the release and modify it for their hardware. Then the OEMs, Samsung and LG, get the OS, test it with their the theme modifications and so forth. And then finally, the carriers get it. And it's usually the carriers that send it out to the users. But each step not only causes delay, but also offers a roadblock. Any one of those people could say, we're not going to update it for those phones. So Project Treble has a vendor interface, a standard interface that sits between the OS and the hardware. The system on a chip vendor, Qualcomm, for instance, plugs into that interface, and then which is basically what we call a hardware extraction layer, and the OS plugs into it. And so that way, the system on a chip vendor doesn't have to do as much work to get the new version of Android working. You still have some customization, but at least that can be done kind of in parallel. You don't have to wait for the system on a chip. So they have a new vendor test suite. This is stuff that when you get your Android phone running Oreo, you're not going to notice change there. But it's a big deal for
security. And you won't notice this for a while. Yeah.
It'll make it possible to update these phones faster and for a longer period of time, which is really I applaud Google for really focusing on that and working on that. Supposedly, they're going to improve battery life. They're going to they have these progressive loading apps now. There's a lot of features. Even a few new, the way the system setting tray works is a little bit different. The problem is you can't really describe it unless we're all talking about Pixel phones, because almost everybody else customizes it heavily and you won't see the same changes. I don't see a huge difference on my Pixel, but you want the latest, I presume.
Well, you see this sort of notification changes.
That's a big change, yeah. Ooh, yeah.
It's called the screen just went to sleep on me. So the notifications have got more distinguishing between them. The live playing one picks up the color.
Right. That's kind of neat.
I'm not going to be able to demonstrate this because you have to get the right kind of notifications, but basically it tells you when there's stuff running in the background.
Right.
And you get those doing there. As you pull down the notifications, you see the little icons come out of there and start turning back in.
Yeah, I like
that. Go back in again.
Yeah.
So there's a set of interesting stuff about the notifications. Also, the apps now get little dots on them. Have I got any? Oh yeah, but Gmail at the bottom has one. But they're not counts like on iOS, because counts are kind of stressful.
It's just a dot saying you've got mail.
Just a little dot saying you've got mail. Then you if you hold it down, it shows you the notification as well.
Oh, that's nice.
And then you can dismiss that on its own or whatever, or click through. So it's not like, oh, this is going to change the world. It's more like they spent a lot of time sweating the details and making a lot of these things that are already quite good a bit better.
They're also clamping down on wake locks, which is the bane of battery life, applications that wake your phone up and keep them awake while they do stuff. Apparently, Android will manage this. There won't be – this is kind of what Apple did and gets very good battery life on the iPhone because of it. Free-running background services are no longer a thing in Android. That's good news.
And when stuff is running in the background, it tells you.
It lets you know, yeah. Let's see. They're going to, a little more efficiency here and there. This is more of an under the hood upgrade than it is a feature update. I don't think.
Yeah, they didn't hype it a lot.
No. The biggest, I think single biggest new feature is this Google Play Protect. Google says, do not install antivirus apps. We'll take care of this. You'll see a badge on the Android device. It'll say Google Play Protect. And I guess, among other things, it continually scans for malware, looking for known flaws. It'll do that for apps on the Play Store, but it will also scan apps that you've downloaded from third parties and sideloaded. Google says it scans 500,000 apps a day, and any newly discovered apps get queued up for deeper analysis. I don't know what else. Let's see.
It says app scanned yesterday at 720.
Yeah.
1720. Yeah.
So I don't know if that's window dressing, because Google did some of this before, although it was only doing it on the Play Store, I guess. A lot of this is about making the phone, I think there's kind of three prongs: more secure, better performance and battery life. And then some cosmetic stuff. Stage fright, which has always been a little bit of a problem, the media framework, is getting a little bit of protection. The house.
That's part of the same trouble hardware abstraction layer. So they've basically made it harder, made fewer things have direct contact with the hardware, and wrap those in abstraction layers so that they've got more control over them. So that's another reason to do that same kind of work.
Web views are sandboxed, running in isolated instances. That's both for reliability and security. You'll have to use a password if you turn on developer options. But most importantly, new emoji. That's the thumbs. Oh, what happens here? This is a Windows thing. The thumbs are gone. They're now round. No more of those, half round.
It's a little sad.
Well, good news. There's an emoji for that. Guy crying. He's laughing so hard he's crying.
There's a puking emoji. There's a hedgehog. Is it giraffe?
Yep. Very exciting. It's funny that you should bring up both the hedgehog and the puking emoji. I think we talked about those same two emoji on Windows Weekly.
But also, the other part of this restructuring is that emoji and fonts are now resources that you can have control over without them being part of the operating system.
Hallelujah.
So that means in future they'll be able to update emoji without having to update the operating system. And if they get this right, that will mean they can backport these emoji to old OSs as well. So they're not as tightly bound.
So when was the last time we used to make a big deal of a new OS, either in computer or phone. I think those days are over. Well, when was the last time you got excited about an OS?
It's all incremental now. I mean, you can't.
Yeah, which is fine.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. I mean, I think that's what's happening with Apple, the new iPhone. But We'll see if Apple delivers. It's very hard to come up with something so new that you go crazy.
Well, I mean, Apple is like the last holdout of the Big Bang release, really.
Yeah.
Everything else has gone continuous. And that is, overall, that's a good thing. You don't have to think about upgrading stuff as much because the upgrades happen in the background silently,
right.
Incrementally, and you don't notice that they've changed. And the browsers going that way was a huge, huge thing that made a massive improvement. And a lot of it is because we have the web and we can do that. You know, I remember when software was stuff that you packaged on CD-ROMs and put in shelves. You know, that's what we had to do so that the process was built that way. And Apple still retains some of that because they release a lot of their software with their new machines. So, you know, in a month or so, they'll push out some new hardware and then we'll suddenly realize what those features in iOS 11 were really for. And that's they're still bound like that, whereas everyone else is much more decoupled now. And overall, that's a good thing. It means that it's easier to patch things, and that often means it's easier to patch security problems as well. But yeah, as you say, you don't say, oh, I've really, you know, don't have the, I've got to queue all night to get Oreo. It'll just like trickle out to your phone at some point.
Right. There's finally color management. I didn't realize this, but Android never had color management. All desktop computers do, of course, but this will help make colors more consistent on different phones. There's a physics-based animation, and there's a new octopus Easter egg.
I was playing with that before, yeah.
Yeah, it used to be a cat, right? Now it's an Easter. Now it's an octopus. To get it, of course, you have to tap the...
Let me go and find it again. Hang on.
Yeah, you have to tap on Android version a bunch of times, then long press on the logo. There was a cat game. Remember the Neko cat game in Android 7. Android 6 had a Flappy Bird, and then press that button, and lo and behold, a squishy octopus will appear.
Apparently,
someday.
Oh, I'm not pressing hard enough.
You weren't quite on the center.
There's also support for SD cards, a new file system, SD card FS. Which might make this has always been kind of a screwy the way SD cards support it. There's a squishy octopus. Oh, he's so cute. He's so cute.
And you can squish him. Hang on.
Boot up times increased, doubled.
even halved, on your hopefully.
Existing OS. Graphics drivers can now be updated. They've been pulled out into the Play Store as an APK. That's good news. Support for Bluetooth 5. Of course, your hardware will also have to support it. That improves the connectivity, doubles it to 50 megabits with quadruple the range and 8 times the messaging capacity over Bluetooth 4 LE. There's also support for aptX, the new Qualcomm's Bluetooth codec for better quality sound, and Sony's LDAC. Again, hardware support is required. There's a printer service. Out of the box, you don't have to download a plug-in anymore.
Oh.
Yeah. Default printer service compatibility with 100 million Mopria-certified printers, Xerox, Brother, Lexmark, Dell, HP, Samsung, Canon, and Epson. 97%, according to Google, of printers sold worldwide. A big improvement here for musicians, a low-latency audio API. This is always, and I always blamed the Linux kernel. This was always a problem for Android users compared to iPad users. There was a 10 millisecond delay in the audio latency, which made it very difficult to do live performance stuff. So you really didn't see a lot of audio apps on Android, but they say they've fixed it. We'll see.
They said they've made it. Well, they haven't really fixed it.
There's a new API.
There's a new API you have to use instead that gives you a fast path.
Yeah.
But it still had the Linux problems, and this is very hard to fix.
And this was something it's in the kernel, right?
Yeah, it's basically the Linux kernel is still a push model, and the iOS kernel is a pull model. And so that dates back to OS X and goes back long enough that I was working there when we were changing it. And the difference is that on OS 10 and iOS, there is a very low level interrupt that is running the audio that is pulling the chain all the way through the system, which means that and it has that has higher priority than memory, which means that it, you can have audio latency without anything gapping. Whereas Linux still has the sort of file system view of audio where you're writing stuff to a file and it buffers it a bit. And if you want it to not gap, you increase the buffer size. So the lag goes up all the time. And that is very hard to fix. And Google has been talking about fixing this properly for several years now. And there's they're walking towards it. But I suspect that the newer kernels they're talking about to replace the Android and Chrome kernels that we've talked about these before may well be what they need to do this in the long run. But in the meantime, they've got a new audio API at the system level that is designed to have a lower latency. And again, it's an opt-in one. You're basically in the same way that iOS and OS 10 did this. You're basically saying, in order to work with this API, I guarantee that I will respond within this time or you will shut me up.
So there it is. Thanks to Ron Amadio for a 20,000-word summary. There's a lot in
there. I mean, if you care about Android, this is definitely worth reading.
Yeah.
He's done a
great job, yeah.
That was a useful hour and a half to read.
Yeah. And I think we gave you the highlights there. This is the Essential Phone. Mine came yesterday. I did not get a pre-production version. It is a very apparently beautiful. I mean, when you hold it in your hand, you'll love it. Titanium and ceramic build. It's got these two little pogo pins up here on the back for the doohickeys. There's a 360-degree camera.
I'm impressed
so far.
You know the jargon for what you call those pins.
Well, you see them on a lot of devices, including the new iPads, the smart connector, and it's just... you know, electrical connectors. I have to say, when I first opened it up, I said, what is it, an extra flash? But on a closer inspection, you see they're actually just metal connectors. There's dual lenses. The camera is buggy as heck. I was hoping that they would have fixed this. A lot of the reviewers mentioned this in the pre-production. It's latent. It crashed the phone, did a hard reset for me once, crashed itself another time. But it does have a monochrome mode, which looks quite good. Takes advantage, I guess, of the dual lenses. The dual lenses aren't like on an iPhone where you can zoom in. They're both active all the time, I gather, because there's no separate lens.
Are they right next to each other?
Yeah. Ooh. Pretty That's close. Weird. Not sure. I'm not sure exactly how that works. But there are still problems with the camera app. I've heard some people sideload the Google Camera APK, and it's faster and works better. So I expect Essential will fix the camera. You look at it, and it's not only is it a fingerprint, it's beautiful, but it's a fingerprint magnet, and there's the monochrome mode of it, and it really looks fragile. In fact, we already got some hairline scratches on the bottom. I've only had it a day. Jason Howell had it yesterday for All About Android. I'm going to give it back to him after this so he can review it for the new screensavers.
Your staff says that Jason ruins all phones.
And unaccountably, it's already got a crack in the glass on the front. And I know I didn't do that, but I think, and Jason, I don't think, dropped it. So I think I'm wondering now, this could be a manufacturing defect. I don't know. The screen is beautiful. It's just, you know, if you compare it, I'll show you. It's got a screen roughly the same size as the iPhone 7, 5.5-inch screen. If you compare it to the iPhone 7, though, you'll see how much smaller it is, and that's where the lack of bezels really makes a difference. All phones going forward will have a lack of bezels. So there's one thing that makes that difficult is the camera on the front. If you don't have a frame, the camera has to notch out the screen. Apple's apparently going to do this as well. And the good news is on Android, because of it's where the notification bar is, and the notifications are kind of split between left and right, it's you know, you see it, but it's not functionally going to make too much of a difference. Maybe on a game it will, or something like that. It does not have a headphone jack, and to me that's kind of a deal breaker. It's Type C charging, and it comes with a Type C adapter so that you can connect a headphone jack. But I just have to wonder, why don't they include headphone jacks? I guess to save space. And it does feel great in the hand. It's very small. But this is not going to be, given that we've got the Note 8 coming out, we've got the LG V30 coming out, we've got an iPhone next generation coming out, and it's early in October, Google's expected to announce the new Pixels. I don't know if there's room for this phone. It is practically a virgin Android. I can't even see any customizations. But it's 7.1.1. So it's right. Not the most recent Android.
It's not running the audio, yeah.
Yeah. It's not even running the most recent Android 7. So it's unknown how often it will update or whether it will update to Android. But I have to think this is...
I assume that they'll be working on the trouble stuff because of who's running it. And
Andy Rubin's company. I mean, he's the guy who created Android, right? So, yeah. And I think that's...
He understands abstractions.
If anybody besides Andy Rubin were making this phone, I think it'd be just a complete non-starter. But aesthetically, it is gorgeous. The materials used are gorgeous. I'm sure they'll fix the camera issue. Get a case for it.
Yes.
It's sad because...
I always get a case.
Yeah, but you design a beautiful phone, but it doesn't matter because if it's in a case, it could be ugly. It doesn't matter, right?
Well, I mean, this came with a transparent case, but I dropped it enough that it shattered, so now I've got a rubber case.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And it's, you know, exactly. I've got a pretty blue phone inside this black thing.
Who cares?
You'll never see it.
Yeah. You'll see it when you sell it.
And it's got a weird hole in the back for my finger to go on.
Yeah. Yeah, that is one thing I have to say. Samsung really screwed the pooch with the fingerprint reader. The way the Samsung phone does it next to the camera is just a terrible, terrible idea. This is a Pixel XL style or Pixel style fingerprint.
That's good. I was confused by it originally, but it's actually really nice.
It works. So you just have how you hold it.
You're picking it up
it's
like
very
that.
Natural. Yeah.
You think it's there. Yeah.
Yeah. And because it is a small phone with a big screen and virtually no bezel, it fits in the hand. It feels good. This is, I could see executives buying this phone just because it looks so good. Just don't drop it. We will have iFixit on the new screensavers as well. They said it is one in repairability because it is just terrible. It's just you can't take it apart. They were underwhelmed, and there are already rumors there'll be a second generation coming soon, fixing some of these complaints. So, it's interesting. It's Andy. I'm glad Andy's doing something. I have all the respect in the world for him. He worked at Danger.
Absolutely.
He worked at Android and then sold the company to Google. Now, there's a review by Daryl Etherington in TechCrunch who said how the Essential Phone won me over completely. And
it's emotional here.
Yeah, it is an emotion. You know what? It is kind of emotional when you see it. You hold it. It really feels very, very nice. But the fact that it's cracked already has kind of taken some of the luster off. He praises the monochrome camera. This is a fine phone, but in a very competitive field that is going to be extremely crowded in the next 2 months. Let's see.
So I think there's some good news here too. I just want to mention the Tech Dirt's fight is over.
Oh, Mike Masnick, did he win?
That is great news. Yes.
Yeah, this is good news. I just want to mention this. Yes, it's under other.
Judge dismissed it.
Wow.
Shiva Ayudara's defamation suit. This guy's long effort to say that he invented email and he goes after everybody. He went after Gawker and won a settlement.
A federal judge in Massachusetts has dismissed the libel lawsuit. Let me see what the judge said here. He found it's because it's impossible to define precisely and specifically what email is. Ayudurai's claim is incapable of being proven true or false. The judge continued, one person may consider a claim to be fake if any element of it is not true or if it involves a slight twisting of the facts, while another person may only consider a claim to be fake if no element of it is true.
Well, that's an issue for a fake news debate of these days.
Yeah. They did not win under California's anti-slap law, so Masnick cannot have his legal fees paid. Of course, there's always a possibility of appeal, but he was denied permission to amend the complaint and refile it, so he would have to appeal to a higher court. This is very good news. This is U.S. District Judge F. Dennis Saylor. And I think that's actually exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's exactly right.
Yeah.
it's weird to think that, I mean, I don't want to get sued by this guy, but it,
right, exactly. I don't either.
Speaking of a chilling effect, but it's weird to think that somebody could have invented email. What was the year? He was like as late as the 70s. I'm trying to remember.
it was long after email had been invented. Yes.
Yeah. It was long after I was using email. He claimed he invented it in high school. It just didn't. He said he was a high school student in the late 70s. And invented email.
Well, this is another one of these things where the idea of invented is just misunderstood.
Right.
And the patent system sort of leads people towards this nonsense. But,
right,
you know, inventing is not thinking of something. Inventing is actually making it work.
He does have a copyright for his program called email.
So what?
There were no software patents.
I could have
a
copyright for the words I say on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone has to cover everything they write ever. You know, that was what happened with the Basel copyright thing in 1976, whenever it was.
So I wish Stacey were here for one story. Well, every story. I wish Stacey were here for every story. No offense,
well,
Kevin, but this one story in particular, Juicero.
Oh, the Juicero story. Yeah. Remember that Stacey knows Doug Evans, right?
I know she does. That's why I'd love to hear
perspective. And she said, has said in the past that he's a nice guy. He was a restaurateur, an entrepreneur. His restaurants, what were they called? Organic Avenue, something like that, went bankrupt. But he started this juice company called Juicero, initially crowdfunded at $700. They raised a considerable amount of money, whoa, sorry about that. I hate autoplay video. Have I mentioned that? They raised considerable amount of money. Google's venture capital arm and other backers poured $120 million into Juicero. They eventually got the machine down to $400 plus the cost of a subscription to the juice packs. The juice press, according to Doug Evans, wields 4 tons of force, enough to lift 2 Teslas. But turned out, Bloomberg tried this, you could squeeze it with your hand. And so if you could get the juice packs without the Juicero, which you couldn't, you could just squeeze them out, and it would be exactly the same.
At which point they are Oddwalla.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So Gwyneth Paltrow liked him after working.
Ivanka Trump liked him.
She liked Juicero too, huh?
She tweeted out a support for Juicero, yes.
Doug spent 3 years building a dozen prototypes before devising Juicero's patent-pending press. In an interview with Recode, he likened his work to the invention of a mainstream personal computer by Steve Jobs. And in fact, it was quite over-engineered. There are 400 custom parts in here. There's a scanner. There's a microprocessor. There's a wireless chip. There's a wireless antenna. He actually pitched it as being able to squeeze large chunks of fruits and vegetables, but in fact, the stuff was already juiced in the packages. Anyway, they've gone bankrupt. And the good news is, and this does, I think, speak well of Doug Evans, they're refunding everybody's money. So if you bought a Juicero, whether at $700 or $400, they say, we'll see, they say you'll get
it. I imagine the investors are terribly happy about that.
Yeah. And I saw pictures. Apparently, the number of bodegas in New York and elsewhere were using Juiceros and selling. But that you won't be able to get the packets anymore either. So the packets were only available in 3 states until Tuesday, when the company expanded to 17, because the packages can't be shipped long distances. So the whole thing is just what's most amazing to me is that he raised $120 million. That's amazing.
This is bubbly.
Yeah, that's bubbly.
It's juicy. Right? It's a juicy time.
People look at Dollar Shave Club and a bunch of other companies kind of, you know, doing these subscription services, probably thought, well, juice, right?
No.
Right, but Okay. So, but it's between a literally between a rock and a hard place, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's between.
Well, we have a solution for that.
Just... It's been Naked Juice, Not Waller, which is here's the juice in a thing, put it in your fridge and drink it. And those little metal things that squish citrus that I've got one thing
in
the kitchen.
Well, if you ever bought
a
juicer, I've had an industrial juicer, and those things are
I've got a juicer.
Those are the devil to clean. They're horrible. So I understand why people might have thought, oh, look, if you could simplify this, you know.
No, I mean, if you if you want to like pick apples from the garden and stick them in the juicer and make apple juice, you can do that, and it works. Yeah. But then you've got to spend 15 minutes scrubbing the damn thing with a brush.
That's right.
And it's
so you need a self-cleaning juicer. That's the invention. Maybe
but the point is, this isn't AeroPress, right?
Right.
AeroPress was actually a bit of engineering where they said, okay, coffee making is messy. What if we reduce the essentials? Here's a giant syringe with the filter paper in the bottom.
The best thing ever invented, by the way, and it's only $30.
It's 25 quid. It makes great coffee.
Love it.
I accidentally smashed my French press. I bought one of these and I was like, why was I drinking that bad coffee for so long?
Yes.
So yeah.
Yes. It's the best coffee maker. And it's from the folks who do Aerobee, the fake frisbee.
But the thing is, the point is, this is actually thinking about engineering. It's just like, okay,
right?
How do we make this thing that actually solves the problem of extracting the thing we want, separating the thing we don't want, and making it easier to clean? And it's not you don't buy special little pouches from them. That's the other thing. This is no.
It uses real coffee.
It uses real coffee. You buy filter papers from them. They're like $10 for a 400 or whatever
they
are. They last you a year. Yeah. And this thing will make you coffee. The point is once you get this, you start buying nice coffee because you can taste the damn stuff.
You can taste the difference. We're going to France in 2 weeks. We're bringing an AeroPress with us just in case.
No.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No, Lisa's like, I'm not taking a chance.
That makes sense.
Why not, right?
France.
I know. That's what I said. We're going to the land of coffee. But she also brought one to Ecuador. So,
Jeez.
Juan Valdez
came out together.
Yes, because you get great beans. Yeah. She should have brought a hand burr grinder, however. All right. I love it. The comparison between Juicero and the AeroPress.
That is the difference between an actual disruptive innovation and somebody who's masturbating with too much VC money.
Yeah, but sadly, I doubt Aerobee raised $120 million for the AeroPress.
They didn't need to.
They didn't need to. It's plastic.
I'm sure they've sold millions of dollars worth of the thing.
They've sold 10 to me alone.
Yeah. No, I'm about to buy two more for my sons.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a tech thing that I don't know if you've covered.
Okay.
But it has, since I was last on, this has come out. This is Progressive Web Apps installation has changed in Chrome 60.
Let's talk about that. This is brand new. We haven't talked about this at all. So first of all, what are Progressive Web Apps?
So Progressive Web Apps, it's a marketing term. It's a way of saying that... there was a bunch of things that native apps could do that web apps couldn't do. And so some deep work was done in the standardization process to say, how do we make these things more like apps? What's the advantage of apps? What's the drawback of apps? How do we get the advantage without the drawback? So the advantage of apps was they have more access to the machine. The drawback is you have to do work to install, you have to go to an app store and so on. So what Progressive Web Apps was a set of adjustments to the browser that lets it have something running in the background, which means that you can work when you're offline. You can control what's cached when, which means that it will work completely offline. You can also set it up so that it does notifications and does a bunch of the things that the native apps can do.
And you can do transactions directly, which is the beauty of it for stores and such, is you can do a transaction directly without having downloaded the app.
Exactly.
Can you give me an example of a progressive web app? Do we know of any?
The Washington Post was there. Now they're used a lot more. Advertisers use them like crazy.
Well, I mean, the IndieWeb one I use is Woodwind.
So is it a browser extension?
Okay, what happens is, let me see if I can see this. I'm running Woodwind. I've used it 2 or 3 times. It says install this app. I clicked the install button a couple of minutes ago. When I now click open, it opens up. And instead of being in the browser, it's now in an app.
Okay.
So the browser Chrome at the top has gone. It's now in an app.
Is this only on mobile?
Is that PWA or an instant app?
It's just up as well. It works on desktop as well.
Okay.
So, no, it's an app. So what the thing that changed in Chrome 60 is that it now shows up as an app. It showed up in an app here before. So it's no longer inside Chrome. It's an app. That happened Chrome 53 or something. But the thing now is that it also shows up if I go to the app overview. It now shows up in there too. So they've basically wrapped an APK around it. So Woodwind now is in my list of apps, and it behaves exactly as an Android app because they've wrapped an Android app around it.
And where do you get it? I mean, how do you install it? Where does it come from? Is it a website?
You go to a website. If you use the website 2 or 3 times, it will auto prompt you to open it. Or if it's the right kind of website, it will give you. When you do the save to desktop, it will go through this process instead.
So what is Woodwind's website? Do you know? Can I?
Woodwind.xyz.
Okay. Because I want to see this experience. Now, I'm on Windows running Chrome 60. So Woodwind account is tied to your personal domain name. This is some sort of weird indie web thing, isn't it?
Isn't it? You have to log in with your... Use your known site, yeah.
Yeah.
But you won't see the install dialog stuff on Windows to the same extent. But it will work. At the moment you only get this on Firefox Mobile, and you get it on Chrome, Chrome Android.
So what is new in 60?
What is new in 60 is that it actually makes an APK from it. So before it would show up when you click the. It would show up in the list of apps that you scroll through. What's new is that it now also shows up in the app drawer as well, so it feels more like an app.
So this is kind of like those Chrome apps that we had that Google deprecated.
Yes.
But it's a completely different loading experience.
Okay, so if you want another one, you can go to Jeremy's site. Hang on.
What, from a point of view of an end user, what's the value? Okay, now I'm finally authenticated.
Woodwind probably isn't the best one because it requires a bunch of indie web stuff to get going.
Yeah.
The value from the end user is that you start off using a website and it becomes an app transparently without you noticing what's going on.
Ah, but then it shows up, at least if you're on a mobile device, it shows up in your app drawer. What does it look like on a desktop?
It looks like an app icon on the desktop.
So really? Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Progressive web apps. Now, better than ever. Are a lot of people embracing this technology?
Yes. No, I mean, people are starting to see that this is, particularly if you've got something that is very web-bound.
And you don't want to set up a roadblock to people to install the app. That's a big problem. I could see why a newspaper, for instance, might use this. If I keep going to the Washington Post, eventually I have a Washington Post app kind of magically.
Yes. But Kevin, isn't that also, there's also, at the same time, there's progressive web apps and Android instant apps.
Yeah, that's sometimes I confuse the two, but those are different.
So Android Instant Apps is to be able to pull a piece of an app out and serve it on the web. A progressive web app is a web page that has so much in it, it acts like an app. No? Is that the simplest?
So progressive web apps is, it's a web page that gradually turns into an app. So, okay, another example, resilientwebdesign.com, which is Jeremy's book. He made that into a progressive web app just because he could. So if you go to that on Android, and you can read the book. and then it will offer to install it as a web app, and then you get the little you get it as an app shows up here.
That's really interesting.
And then if I click that resilience, it pops up and there's the book again.
Oh, that's really cool.
So you can do this. You can create a web app around content that will then work when it's offline. So if I airplane mode this.
See, I do that all the time. I think, oh, I want to download this site, or I want to somehow capture this so I can continue. In this example of Jeremy's book, you know, I could easily see downloading the PDF so I could read it. So if I just go back to the site a bunch.
It's cached all the pages now, yeah.
Yeah. So, and that just does it the first time you visit, or does it?
I think it's like the second or third time you visit.
That's a great idea.
So yeah.
Do people mind? I mean, it's a 7 megabyte download. Do they mind that I have this 7 megabytes of this? Is it in cache? Where does it store?
It's a caching thing. So it's stored as a cache part of the browser.
Okay.
You could probably abuse this a little, and then the browser will start unloading you.
Right.
But yeah, for textual content, there's no real pain from it.
Right. Neat.
But it's this subtle thing that's this is like the end run of like about 3 years worth of work to say, how can we make the web more app-like? Right. How can we make this part of the experience? And it's now very, very smooth. So if you're developing something that is primarily content-like and web-like, this is just going to make the experience smoother for many more people. And another key thing is that the offline stuff works better.
So a really good use for, say, I'm thinking about us. If you came to our website, twit.tv, a few times to download podcasts, it would just kind of automatically show up as an app in your phone.
Yes, absolutely. How
do users feel about that? Do they mind that?
They have to click a button and say yes, add it.
Okay. Okay.
But it will prompt them to do that.
But it definitely eliminates that barrier.
And then when there's a new episode, you can make a notification come up and say there's a new episode.
See, that's nice. I like it. How hard is it to develop these? I like this.
It's not too bad. I mean, they're basically developing a website. There's a manifest file you can add that describes what basically gives it an icon and says it can go on the desktop. Yeah. You have to have HTTPS. And you have to create a piece of code that will run to do this work of the caching and to handle the notification.
So is it essentially a web view, or is it something different?
It's an enhanced web app. It's basically a web page that has some extra powers.
Okay.
It's also AMP-based, right?
Oh, is it?
No, it's kind of orthogonal to AMP, but it's complementary. Okay. So you can, the nice thing about AMP is that it gives you compact things that you can run that will give you a standalone experience. And so if you combine that with the progressive web app, which is what that WAPO thing did when they still had it, it would give you a bunch of stories that were offline, so that you could then read them on the subway or whatever. So there's a nice complementarity between the two, but they're actually working in slightly different domains.
And then there's Facebook like buttons, which account for 16% of an average website's code.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
It really is.
It's a lot of JavaScript, right?
Caching stuff.
Yeah. Wow. But people want these features. That's why they put Facebook commenting on their web pages, they put like buttons, but you're ending up downloading a whole bunch of stuff.
Facebook's theory, this is Facebook trying to be OS-like, if you like. So they've got an SDK that includes all the things that are Facebook-flavored stuff you can do. And the assumption is, once you've downloaded this once, you've got it for all the sites that are using it. So the pain of downloading it isn't that high. But it does mean that you've still got to download it once wherever you are, but also you've still got to execute all this code, and just doing that will take a bunch of time. And that article is worth reading to see what the overhead of that is.
Yeah. It's like it's like these apps, like I'm thinking of the Atom text editor, which are basically
you're downloading Chrome, basically.
Yeah.
Plus a bunch. You're basically, it's a browser you're downloading with a bunch of JavaScript.
So does that Facebook button work in AMP?
Does the Facebook button work in AMP? I bet not.
Won't work in AMP because AMP really doesn't let you download that library. But if Facebook wants to conform to the AMP pieces, they can do it. So this will be one of these, like, he says, she said things that I suspect won't actually happen.
Well, AMP also sets the library, right? So AMP says, here's the library of things that are downloaded to every browser using AMP, and does that or does not. It includes things like slideshows. Does it or it includes trackers? Does it or does it not include Facebook stuff? It's a really interesting kind of little antitrusty thing going on there.
Well, it's a little. It's one of those, like, you've got to wrap your thing inside my thing to make it work. So I don't know yet. I suspect Facebook will resist that because they prefer being the, having had previous here. Facebook would prefer to have their own thing and rely on the fact that they have the ability to get it installed. Which, you probably have that installed. You go to enough media sites, it'll be there. But what you'll find is that it's also running that code in every web page you're viewing, and that the overhead of that is high.
Yeah. If you drive around LA or New York, you might see these billboards, big white billboard with just the simple text, Netflix is a joke. Turns out they're bought by Netflix, of course. So I guess we'll find out what it's probably referring to, some comedy series that Netflix is going to launch at some point. These guys know how to market.
Yep.
Maybe, I don't know. We'll find out. Amy Schumer said she'd asked for and received money for Netflix for her stand-up special. After she said she wanted more money when she learned that Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle were each getting $20 million for their special. Amy Schumer said, hey, I want some of that Netflix money. A very subtle goodbye to Solaris. The last bit of sun has finally gone out.
Is that what this? Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Oracle has laid off all the Solaris tech staff. And this is, I think there's not much left of the Sun acquisition at Oracle. Just mentioning it.
Was it worth buying?
Well, it turns out I think this is widely agreed now, that all Oracle really wanted was the right to sue Google for billions of dollars.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
That hasn't worked out that well. So apparently that was, I talked to Jonathan, was it Jonathan Schwartz or somebody? Who was at the meeting when Larry Ellison came to Sun, and when he heard the bit about, well, we haven't sued him, but we honestly feel like Google's infringing our requirements on Java. Larry Ellison apparently rubbed his hands in glee. I wish it was a triangulation interview. I'm sure we'll find it at some point. All right, let's take a little bit of a break because we still want some picks of the week and numbers of the week. Before we wrap this thing up, our show today brought to you by Capterra. Capterra is a fabulous, free, and easy-to-use software directory. If you're looking for business software, I think a lot of people just probably Google it, but that's a terrible way to find a program that you'll be running your business on. You're just going to get a bunch of undifferentiated search results. What you really like is a directory with all of the possible programs rated, reviewed, feature lists and all of that stuff. And that's exactly what Capterra does in 400 categories. Everything from managing a church to a medical practice to e-commerce to CRM, help desk, field service, applicant tracking, development tools, and on and on and on. 400 plus categories from A-B testing. Let's go to the bottom of the alphabet. All the way to, I think the last one is Q-R-S-T, yoga studio management. Let's say you have a yoga studio and you say, well, I want some software to run my yoga studio. Turns out there's quite a few yoga studio programs, that can run yoga studios. I mean, lots. So let's narrow it down. On the right, you'll see we're going to only do 4-star ratings. We're going to say 10 users. We want it web-based. Maybe you want it installed. You get to pick. Do you want staff management, online payments? Yes. Member management, then filter the results, and you'll narrow it down to the 11 products that do exactly what you want. Then add them to a comparison chart. Pick up to four of them. Let's say these four right here. And then we'll compare them now. And look at this. You're going to get everything you need to know to help you find the right software, including the starting price, whether there's a free trial version, where it's installed, how it runs, what features it has, screenshots. But the best part is the ratings and the reviews. The reviews from real users just like you. Captera has hundreds of thousands of software user reviews, all verified. This is just a fantastic site. Oh, did I mention? It's absolutely free. No charge, no sign up, no salesman will call. It's a service provided by Captera. Absolutely free. You won't get annoying follow-up emails or phone calls. You won't spend weeks or months searching because everything you need is right here. CAPTERRA.com/twig. Find the right software for your business that will save you time every day. Captera. And we thank Captera for their support of This Week in Google. So, Jeff Jarvis, let's start you up. I see you have a few things in here that I saved because I didn't want to steal your number, but you left out one of the numbers I was going to do.
What do you will you hit me with it?
The amount of money Amazon spends on R&D, which exceeds every company in the world, $16.1 billion.
Amazing.
Alphabet 13. Intel 12, Microsoft, the tech companies lead. They're the red bars on this graph. The highest non-tech company is number 6, Johnson & Johnson, General Motors, Pfizer, Ford. But look at that, Amazon.
So this is Amazon, you know, not making a profit. This is Amazon. This is where the investment goes, R&D, and it pays off. Whew. Amazing.
$16 billion. Nobody comes even close. So I wasn't going to mention that because I thought, oh, that'll be Jeff's numbers for sure. But
that's a good one.
You got some other ones.
Well, we got some other ones. We got Google and Udacity are providing 75,000 scholarships for coding and data.
Oh, nice. My daughter's taking a Udacity course on artificial intelligence. She wants to.
Wow. Yeah. Jake finished one on app development.
Isn't it great? Such a good thing. This was a Googler started this, right? A Google X guy. I'm trying to remember.
Sebastian Thrun. No. Was it Thrun?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, he started.
And they have these nano degrees, which you pay for. Some free and some paid.
The nano degrees, you can get a new career, a new job.
Yeah.
Which in this day matters.
Yeah.
So that's one. The other one, just for our amusement, is the top 20 how-to searches in 2017 in Google.
Okay. Guesses anybody? How to tie a tie is number one.
How to tie a tie.
Oh, but it gets weirder. How to kiss? Really?
Number three, if you have to ask Google.
How to get pregnant? More people want to know how to get pregnant than how to lose weight. How to make money? How to make pancakes? How to write a cover letter, how to make French toast, how to lose belly fat. No one's searching for that. Come on. How to write a resume, how to boil eggs, how to draw. Boil eggs. No, I look up hard-boiling eggs all the time because there's a magic method that I can never remember. So I do search for that a lot. But I know how to do it roughly, but I just need to have the details. How to get rid of acne. Oh, number 18, how to love. I want to know how to love. How to hate is not on the list. How to love. How to get rid of fruit flies, very popular.
So Simon Rogers, who's Google's data editor, a friend of mine, says that how-to searches have increased 140% since 2004.
You know, everybody I know learns how to do stuff on YouTube.
Yeah.
My son has basically learned how to cook on YouTube. He says everything. Wow. Everything is on YouTube. He cooks a lot of hot dogs. No, actually, it's not true. When I got my sous vide machine, I learned everything on YouTube. It's amazing. YouTube is the best I would guess that, you know, more education going on YouTube than anywhere. Kevin has returned to us. What did you do, jog around the house?
I had to let the dogs out.
Who let the dogs out? We now know the answer. Kevin,
you can probably hear a dog drinking water in the background.
I do. So, Kevin, I know you'll want to say something about the Indie Web or the Homebrew Website Club or something like that.
Oh, yes. Well, there's Homebrew Website Club tonight. It's in, you've already missed London and Brighton, but we have San Francisco and Baltimore. And new tonight, we have Austin. That's just starting tonight. So go along. If you're in Austin tonight, go along there. 6:30 at Monkey Nest Coffee.
On Burnett Road down there in beautiful Austin, Texas.
Yes.
It's a coffee shop, Monkey Nest. And I see Mozilla's going to have one. And
yes.
Yeah.
Manton will be at the Austin one, who does micro.blog.
And Tantec will be at the Mozilla one.
Yes.
Nice.
That's right.
Nice. Homebrew website.
And there is also a indie web camp this weekend in Dortmund in Germany.
Ooh. That looks like fun.
As part of the Campfire Festival. And they're trying to bring a lot of journalists to that one, so that you should tell your friends, Jeff, because I know you have a lot of German journalist friends.
Ah, yes.
Well, we're all about the indie web and open web, so thank you for the good work you do to promote that. I want to give a big plug to my new...
One more thing to shake. Have you seen this?
No. What? You must go offline to view this page. Wait a minute. Show that. Did you... It says enable airplane mode. That's a website?
It's a website. It's using the Progressive Web App features. And now I'm in offline mode. And
oh, my God. And that's awesome.
The page.
So that's
so basically...
Great demonstration of progressive web apps.
And part of the point of the progressive web app stuff is you can detect when you're offline and you can give them some content you've already cached, or you can give them a page saying, sorry, we're offline, come online again. But so
this is Chris Bolin. And so presumably when I'm on this first page, it's now caching the rest of it.
Right. It's now cached the offline page. And then when you go offline, it will appear. Oops, I didn't send an airplane mode on again. That's my phone.
That'd be kind of fun. Let me see if I can. You can do this on a desktop, I guess, huh?
I think the desktop won't work in the same way, but let's try and see.
All right. I'm trying to figure out how I go offline on this machine.
That's the challenge on the desktop.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I know there should be a little Wi-Fi thing here somewhere. I don't see it, though.
Is this you running Chrome on Windows?
Yeah. Windows.
There's probably a way to do it.
I'll just do this. Oh, there's definitely a way to do it. I just, for some reason, don't see it. Let's go into airplane mode. I am now in airplane mode. Let's return to my page. I've lost everything. Nothing. Come on. I'm offline. Do I have to refresh?
Maybe. You're on Chrome, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's Windows is the problem. Oh, forget it. Do this on your phone. I've lost my mouse now.
You've gone offline.
Having a bad day.
You lost your mouse. Sucks.
Screen goes black.
You crashed my computer. All right. Well, I can't show my pick of the week, but I will be demonstrating it. And if I don't crash it between now and Saturday on the new screensavers, I have the worst luck with drones. I see all these beautiful drone videos people are taking. And finally, Alex Lindsay convinced me, no, you can fly this drone. I've heard this before, by the way. The first drone I ever got, I was told by our drone expert, Father Robert Ballasaire. We call him what do we call him? The what? The quad father. We call him the quad father.
That's good.
Yeah, he's a quadcopter expert. He said, get a cheap one because you'll crash it right away. So I got a $40 drone, used it once, turn it on, said, go up. Started going up. I said, come down. It just went up like a balloon and never came back. I don't know where it ended up. I lost sight of it. So that's $40 down the tube. Next one I bought, $500 Bebop drone that everybody said, you can't crash this. First thing I did, crashed it. And it's ever since, I still have it. If when you
launch it, it falls over like this. So I really wasn't that excited about getting another drone. But then I thought, well, it'd be fun because I'm going to be going on a Caribbean sail with my son, and he wants to make a video and all that. And I said, well, it'd be great if we could have a drone fly over the... So Alex Lindsay convinced me, and you could pull up the, it's from DJI, it's called the Mavic Pro. You fold it up, you can carry it, it's tiny. I mean, it's not a tiny drone, but when you fold it up, it's not big. It's like the size of a computer power supply, sort of. A little expensive, but man, what I learned is we are really in a whole new era of drones. These things are so much better than the early drones. They do so many things. This has all these follow modes. You can set it to recognize you or a person. It will continue to follow you as you ski or run or sail. It can recognize a boat and continue to follow the boat. It can rotate around it, keeping its eye on you. It can follow you in profile. Anyway, I've already flown it a few times and haven't crashed it, which is a good sign.
Knock wood, Leo.
Knock wood, because it's expensive to crash it. But the 4K video looks stunning that I got back. I would show you, but I'm basically offline at this point. I don't know, and I can't get back online. So, but you'll see more. I'll do a full review. In fact, we'll fly it on the new screensavers on Saturday. But I'm very impressed. The Mavic Pro. This is DJI. It's on the camera's on a gimbal. It works with a smartphone. You can plug it in, and they even have. See that they have a VR helmet you can wear if you want.
Jesus, how much, Leo? How much?
1,000. Not too bad.
All right. You're buying an airplane for God's sake.
Well, the main amount of technology in this thing blows me away. So, 1,000. I know it sounds like a lot, but this has got a lot more technology in it than a $1,000 smartphone. I mean, this thing is kind of mind boggling. It flies for a half an hour. It can go 12 miles away, or no, 4 miles away from you. It has GPS built in. So if you do lose track of it, I really need this. It will just come home. Or there's a home button you can press and it will come back to where it took off from and land. And I did try that. It's the first thing I did. I said, well, will it really do that?
It's like find my phone for a drone. That's
yeah. Yeah. And I've lost so many that just that feature alone seems worth it to me. It will come back.
You combine the two. It's like find my phone. The drone goes and gets your phone and brings it back to you.
And the good thing, DJI for $99 has a fix your drone plan that if you do fly into a tree or it gets wet or whatever, that you FedEx it back to them and they'll fix it and send it back to you. So I bought I bought the insurance.
How much is the insurance?
$99.
I know.
It was worth it, believe me, after losing.
Is there a deductible?
I didn't even inquire. I just knew I needed it. I'm sure. I don't know. That's a good question. I'll let you know the minute I use it because I'm sure I will be. But review on Saturday. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Thank you, Kevin Marks, for filling in for Stacey. Always a pleasure. Find him at indieweb.org at Kevin Marks. I love doing this show because I get to be around really smart people and learn stuff. Smart people like you, Kevin, and like you, Jeff Jarvis, professor of journalism at CUNY. Blogger at buzzmachine.com at Jeff Jarvis on the Twitter. He told me that on Twitter, I want to ignore trolls and racism. You said, no, you have to fight racism wherever, because if it were in person, I'd say something. But I feel like on Twitter, it's like.
I think we have to start to expect civility from others.
Yeah.
And demand it. When we don't, we're somewhat culpable. When we encourage the incivility, when we say, fight, go look at that funny, we're equally guilty.
No, I like it. I like it. Let's bring civil discourse back to the commons. Stacey will be back next week, I think. Yes. Jeff, you traveling or can you come back next week?
I think I'm here. I owe Carsten a list. I think gone one time this month.
And Kevin, we'll have you back very soon. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday afternoon, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to watch live, go to twit.tv/live. And if you do watch live, you should also be in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. Join those crazy kids in the back of the class throwing the spitballs. They're actually a huge help to us, and it's always fun to have them. If you want to be in studio live, we often have studio audiences for the shows. All you have to do is email tickets at twit.tv. We'd be glad to get a seat and you can come and join us and watch the fun. But I know most of you have other things to do in life, so we make on-demand versions of everything we do available at our website. In this case, twit.tv/twig,
or use your favorite podcast application, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, Slacker, iTunes, Overcast, and subscribe. That way you'll get every single episode. Thanks for joining us this week. We'll see you next time on This Week in Movies. Bye-bye.